Hello, I am Eli Adachi, Professor of Medical Science at Brown University and host of Medscape One-on-One. Joining me today is Dr. Nan Hayworth, an ophthalmologist by training, who is presently serving as the representative of the 19th Congressional District of the State of New York. Welcome.
Thank you, Doctor. Thank you.
What a privilege it is
for me
to have you on our programs.
Entirely mine, but thank you.
These days, it's almost impossible not to launch the conversation without reflecting on last week's Supreme Court deliberations.
Yes.
I am certain our viewers would be thrilled to hear what a seasoned observer such as yourself might be thinking about what transpired, what could potentially follow, and what it would mean ultimately to the healthcare system that you know so well.
Yes. Certainly, interestingly enough, my observations are made, yes, from the congressional perch, which informs thoughts about the consequences of the decision. We don't have, as you might well guess, we don't have any inside track as far as the Supreme Court's deliberations per se, but I anticipate that they will find the individual mandate unconstitutional. And then, of course, the more exciting question and the pressing question is, what happens to the remainder of the law?
Yes.
Is it severable? Will they rule the entire law void, if you will?
Mm-hmm.
I think it's 50-50. I think the mandate will go. I don't see how the Commerce Clause can be stretched to that degree. Certainly people like me, and I'm not alone. We do have some Democratic colleagues who feel similarly, although primarily this is the House Republican majority, as you know, feel that the Affordable Care Act has worthy goals that we should honor, but that as a law, it is damaging to us and does need to be replaced. And the exciting question, obviously, is how do we do that?
Right.
And we are thinking about those things very vigorously in the House, as you might imagine.
So the sense you convey is that there may be elements in the Affordable Care Act that perhaps both sides of the aisle could embrace.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we could cover at least one of those
that
comes to mind as an element of the bill that could actually be a focus of agreement.
Mm-hmm. Well, most of us, I think, like the fact that the law acknowledges the need for everybody, I think, lauds the fact that we recognize that everybody needs to have affordable, portable health insurance and to have access to good, affordable care. Many people have expressed a desire to retain the provision that requires that insurers provide for dependents up to the age of 26. That's a fairly straightforward task, I think. But fundamentally, because it's not a very costly population, obviously, but fundamentally, the whole idea of how we approach a paradigm shift in American medicine is the question, and it's compelling. My contention is that we face a paradigm shift at this point, no matter what. The Affordable Care Act was essentially an attempt to introduce a mechanism very much like the National Health Service in Britain to map that onto the consumer landscape that is American medicine. We have, and I would contend, we have a very different medical culture in the United States, Doctor, and I would love to hear your point of view on this because that's certainly been mine.
No, I believe we need an American solution. What it is, perhaps, is elusive, but I agree with you.
Yes.
The American solution is not likely to be comparable to its European counterpart, for example.
That would certainly be my contention. Having practiced, now my background was that I trained in New York City at Cornell, an esteemed academic center, and then migrated to the New York metropolitan area, which of course has very sophisticated medical consumer with high expectations. That is not necessarily the case throughout the United States, as you and I both know. But certainly my vision of the American medical consumer, if you will, is that he or she expects the most advanced modalities to be available and to be available immediately when they're needed. That is, I think, the natural issue of what happened in American medicine starting at the beginning of the 20th century. We are a medical culture that certainly our training is intense. We want to provide vigorously and well, and that requires resources. And when a third party is paying, as it was an artifact, of course, as we all know, of policy, employment policy after World War II, and then, of course, Medicare in 1965, we have created a very costly structure. And, of course, the Affordable Care Act is an endeavor to deal with that. But I think it is sown with the seeds of its own destruction, if you will, especially if the individual mandate goes. Because the Affordable Care Act hinges on two factors, primarily an individual mandate and also, of course, a mechanism by which access to care will be controlled, in this case, the Independent Payment Advisory Board, which I don't view as a death panel, but we both know that access to care is materially determined by the providers, whether that be, of course, a physician or a hospital, ultimately, or other providers, by their ability to sustain the means of delivering that care.
Yes. Well, multiple layers of uncertainty, I think, were exposed by your articulate response, and we're all going to have to wait, yes. I think, is probably the bottom line. With that in mind, I thought we could turn our attention to Medicare, which in many ways is likewise an ongoing challenge that presently appears to be addressed in two fundamentally different ways. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, by the Affordable Care Act and the administration. On the other hand, by Representative Ryan's proposals and the support it receives from his ranks. Would you take a minute, perhaps, for the benefit of our viewers, to compare and contrast these opposing worldviews and perhaps state your preference in the process and why?
Well, our challenges with Medicare are parallel, if you will, or are in, I can't even really call it microcosm because Medicare is such an important part of American medicine, but they certainly reflect the problems that are created by the Affordable Care Act in that we have a third-party payer mechanism in which the recipients of care, those who for whom the insurance is intended to provide, and who depend on that insurance. Our seniors very much rely on Medicare. But we certainly have a very costly delivery system that is, sadly, because of the fact that Medicare, when first passed, was not indexed for life expectancy. So what was designed to be a fairly limited program, of course, is the 2 years prior to average life expectancy. That was when people became eligible for Medicare in 1965. But, of course, now people live 20 or 30 or more years beyond, and I certainly my own parents, 88 and 91, I wouldn't trade a day with them. But what they paid into Medicare is far outstripped by a multiple of three or four or more in terms of what will be provided to them, which is why, as we all know, the Medicare Trust Fund is rapidly running out of its resources because we are now in a net negative balance, and so the predictions have been accelerated in terms of their in terms of its expiration. Now it's some estimates say 2016. So how do we assure that Americans who are counting on Medicare will be able to have it in generations to come? Yes. How do we honor the obligations that we have to our seniors who absolutely have no alternative for the most part? And I think the Wyden-Ryan plan, which is incorporated into the budget act that we just, or the budget bill that we just passed through the House, unlikely, to say the least, to pass the Senate. But certainly that's part of our plan. And it is to try to rationalize and preserve Medicare for future generations. We honor the obligations we have to our current seniors and those who will imminently be receiving Medicare. But for members of the baby boom generation who are under 55, and 10,000 boomers a day now are entering Medicare, as you know, which is why the trust fund is running out so rapidly. But for those who are 55 and under, there will be a new way of providing alternatives through which we hope to have a consumer-based, consumer-driven mechanism rather than mandates and boards that are coercive. You know, that we want to be able to empower our citizens to make sensible decisions. And I think that broad principle applies as well to the Affordable Care Act. So there are analogies there. So what Wyden-Ryan does is provides for regional differences in the cost of care, in medical, again, medical consumer culture, if you will. It does allow the option of participating in a traditional fee-for-service Medicare plan, but also the option of purchasing with premium support, which is not a voucher. There, premium support carries with it an assurance that you will have the care you need, not limited by means and not limited by severity of pre-existing conditions, but we will have provision for you. There are parallels, of course, to Medicare Part D, which has an array of plans. It does require consumer engagement. That's true. But I think that's a reasonable request of intelligent people who are empowered to make those decisions.
In a way, markets versus mandates.
Exactly.
Perhaps once.
Exactly. The American way. and that's important. It's important to have that acceptance.
Perhaps while we are on safety net arrangements, our viewers probably would appreciate your insight into Medicaid as well, and perhaps in particular as it relates to the state of New York.
Yes.
And what perhaps could change for the better or worse if Medicare would shift from the current federal-state partnership to essentially a state block grant arrangement wherein the primary responsibility will rest with the state.
Right.
There must have been examples in the past in New York where times may not have been as good as they could have been, and one perhaps could learn something from those examples as to what would transpire in the future in a state such as New York if we were to switch to block grants? And that's a possibility.
Well, it is, Doctor. And as you know, the Medicaid reimbursement structure, the Medicaid menu of services, the way in which the states require individuals, communities, counties. In New York, of course, there are heavy burdens on our counties in particular to participate in the cost of Medicaid. So every state varies, which is why one of the at least theoretical virtues of a block grant system is that it says, or a block grant arrangement, is that it streamlines the federal role. So presumably we're saving on bureaucracy. We're allowing for every dollar, as we should with Medicare, to be sure, allow every dollar that we can to flow into care. But, of course, it also means that for a state like New York, which has built up a very heavy Medicaid structure and an enormous menu of services, more so, I think, more generous and more costly than that of any other state. Mm-hmm. And right now they, of course, have a federal match for that. Right. They've been incentivized to have a federal, mm-hmm. to do more because they get a federal match. So for a state like New York, it's a problem, and it's a problem for our hospitals. I've heard about that in a certain amount of detail, and I'm sure I'll be hearing more. And I hear from our counties. I talk with our local government officials, too. And I also talk with our providers, who are very worried about being able to care for the neediest among us. And that's the crux of the issue, really, is how do we allow that, lofty and virtuous yes. goal to be fulfilled? We yes. do want to provide for the neediest among us.
On a smaller budget.
Without Phil Graham from Texas, the senator now, of course, retired, but has referred to the analogy of pulling along a wagon, you know, and your friend who really can't walk alongside you, you know, you want to pull along the wagon, but it becomes hard when we all want to get into the wagon. So, you know, somewhere finding that level of restraint. It's hard when you have pre-existing structures.
Yes.
But if I may offer, and this is a model I'd like to see applied when we think again, sort of looping back to the Affordable Care Act.
Yes.
I think if we try to look for models. Where is there a consumer-driven mechanism that works? And I think we can look to the state of Indiana. And Mitch Daniels, who is a governor Republican and a Democratic legislature, at the very least a mixed legislature, and he's had a Democratic majority for a fair amount of time. Mm-hmm. Put together a program called Healthy Indiana, which funds health savings accounts for the state's Medicaid recipients mm-hmm. with state funds. Now, they happen to pay for them through a cigarette tax. Any state can do it any way they want, mm-hmm. but that's the way they do it. And then they allow an easy mechanism for state employees to fund their own health savings accounts through pre-tax dollars. And what they found is that the people who hold these accounts have dealt with them intelligently. Mm-hmm. No one can fall through the cracks. Most of them buy catastrophic insurance, not what Milton Friedman termed very costly prepaid health care, but catastrophic insurance to cover the big expenses. Mm-hmm. They pay for routine care, diagnostics, pharmaceuticals, et cetera, out of their accounts. And it's been very well received. Voluntary participation by state employees went from 4% originally, about 4 years ago. Now it's over 90%, if I'm not mistaken. And the state saved tens of millions of dollars. So have the account holders. It's a model that could work across the country.
So Indiana may have crossed that bridge or has begun to do so.
Exactly.
While other states may well have to follow.
In a nonpartisan way, yes, sir. So I'd love to, and I talk about Healthy Indiana whenever I can, because I think as policy makers, that's a great model. If we could combine a model like that, HSAs for Everyone is the basic way we fund our health care as consumers, a consumer-driven system that allows a market mechanism to provide yes. for those appropriate controls, which really, you know, when Medicare came in, that's when the unit price of medical care, as you know better than I, sir, soared in the United States, because when the federal government is writing the checks, there's not the same sort of market mechanism.
Yes.
And it doesn't have to be a deprivation. It's not. It's just a way of making sure that things fall into place naturally. Liability reform and open up the insurance marketplace.
We'll come back to the latter point, I think, because it is important to providers, as you know well.
Yes.
But before we do, another issue that is obviously of great interest to physician providers in particular is the issue of reimbursement under
yes.
Medicare.
Oh, yes.
And the constraints or the threat of a constraint as it relates to the sustainable growth rate formula.
Yes.
As one who has by now had a ample opportunity, I'm sure, to both observe and digest some of the lessons that have already been learned, what could you say to our viewers with respect to a likely solution, timing of such? Mm-hmm. Where is this going to go, and what should we be looking for?
That is a challenge that really does require the voice of every physician who can devote any energy or thought to this problem. It is a challenge that, as you know, can also pit certain groups of physicians against others in a variety of ways. Primary care versus specialists obviously comes to mind. The sustainable growth rate formula has been overridden in nearly every year since its inception in, I think it was 1998 was when it became law, roughly 13 years ago, 14 years ago. And it desperately needs to be reformed. We do not have a clear path yet on this, and I know that there have been various recommendations, and I think there's going to have to be a task force approach. We have extended the current payment schedule through the end of this year. I would love to see action taken before the end of this year. The likelihood of that happening, Doctor, is slim to none, probably, until we know what the composition of the next Congress and administration will be. Because the question, obviously, is how do we accommodate the needs of our patients and those who care for them? We talked about it at the beginning of our conversation, but access is determined by reimbursement schedules to a certain degree. It's not necessarily a one-to-one ratio, but a lot of the reason it's not one-to-one is because there's a certain amount of cost shifting that we've been able to do in practices of all different sizes, as you know. It is a painful problem, but one that we can't avoid.
So difficult and not likely this year. Right. Would be probably one way to sum it up.
Exactly, and that is a very unsatisfactory answer, I recognize. But I do think that we're going to have a task force sit down with representatives from all the different physician sectors, specialists, primary care, academic, hospital-based physicians, private practice, multi-specialty groups, all of them, you know.
I don't want to lose our earlier train of thought with respect to liability reform. Here again, I'm sure providers are keen to hear from any legislator, especially a physician legislator. What could be in the cards? When could it be in the cards? Or is it even a national issue? You might subscribe to the view that this is more of a state-driven solution, and some do.
Mm-hmm.
Any insight that you can provide us on this, again, ongoing issue, I think would be greatly appreciated.
With regard to Medicaid?
With respect to liability reform.
Oh, yes. Oh, gosh, Doctor.
Reform.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
We did pass in the House of Representatives, and this was essentially along a party line vote. We did pass a reform measure which would provide for
session.
Yes, sir, we did. Yes. Along with, it was combined with repeal of the Independent Payment Advisory Board. And we voted in favor. It was all a Republican vote for liability reforms to be begun, at least nationally, including caps on non-economic damages. That was a prominent feature. Safe harbor provisions. Sensible things. Politically, it is extremely difficult. There are relationships in terms of the liability. I don't want to use a pejorative, but the liability industry, if you will. We do need appropriate protections, obviously, from malpractice, from harm. We need recompense when a genuine injury has been committed, if you will. But there are far less costly mechanisms that I think most Americans could embrace, and I think there are institutional barriers that we absolutely have to overcome, and the only way we're going to overcome them is with political pressure. And I know, as having served as a case reviewer for New York State's Office of Professional Medical Conduct, that there are far less costly ways of administering those consumer protections, those patient protections, and of identifying and removing from practice, if need be, those who cannot observe appropriate protections.
Thank you. We're going to close perhaps on a personal note, if you'll permit us.
This has flown by.
And really briefly ask, what and when, or when and where, perhaps, did you make the all-important decision to embark on public service, having started your career as a dedicated professional, but at some point obviously moved on? Maybe a few comments on how that happened and the central events that drove that transition.
Well, thank you, sir. That's a marvelous question. I practiced for 16 years as an ophthalmologist and was delighted to do so and considered it a gift and a privilege. I was in a solo practice and then in a multi-specialty group in Mount Kisco, New York. And I retired from practice actually in 2005, well ahead of my congressional service, if you will, in deference to motherhood. And so there are all sorts of parallels that some of your listeners may be thinking right now. It was my husband's also a physician. He's a physician executive, and our children needed more time from one of us, and we were both absolutely dedicated to our fields, as we should be. Not that we weren't dedicated to our children, but, you know, life's necessities come to play. So I actually stepped out of practice in 2005, was at home with our sons for 2 years, still active in OPMC in New York State, case reviewer and doing various things. In 2007, I returned to working outside the home. The boys were older, and I was a medical director at a communications company. Mm-hmm. And the 2008 election cycle was as it unfolded. I was the resident voice in Manhattan among colleagues who tended to lean left of the fiscal conservative. And I was cutting my rhetorical teeth on what became, when the results of the election were established, became a calling, if you will, to observe and honor and promote, with the background that I do have, the cause of individual liberty that I felt was threatened by well-meaning but really dangerously costly acts of the administration and Congress. And it was that passion to preserve what is quintessentially and irreplaceably American, but not merely because it's American, but because we have had privileges and opportunities that no other society in history or in the world has had, that no other citizens have had. And if a government expands to such a degree that it provides for all, then it invades all as well. When I say all, I mean for all needs, if you will. We want to provide for those who cannot do for themselves. But there are ways in which the best of intentions can become, unfortunately, overwhelming, oppressive, and wrong. So that drove the campaign, and
And there you are.
Yes, sir, and I view so many parallels with medical care because I have to listen to my constituents. I have to understand their problems, just as I did in medical practice. Mm-hmm. I have to care about them primarily. It's not about me. It's about them. It's about the citizens I serve, and I have to craft solutions with them that they can apply effectively in their own lives.
Thank you.
Thank you.
On that note, sincere thanks to Representative Hayworth and to you, our viewers, for joining Medscape One-on-One. Until next time, I am Eli Adashi.